again for a second time with, what are you guys talking about?
What are you guys talking about?
Alright, there we go. Trying to fix, we hope those are lag problems, otherwise Ed's going slightly crazy over there, so...
I'll just have to, like, not interrupt you, like you interrupt me.
Constantly interrupt you. And he does, I love the look on his face, because when I stopped him to do the intro again, it was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm sorry, but it will be done properly. Now, welcome everybody to another episode of What Are You Guys Talking About? We're changing format a little bit here, so we've been on the indie filmmaker kick for a while, and we're still going to talk as indie filmmakers, but I have just come to the end of the MCU deep dive, so we are going to have probably, I would say, about three different episodes. I would say... definitely doing Captain Marvel today. That's today's episode. So if you want to go out and watch Captain Marvel and come back to us, please by all means do. It's an awesome movie. And then next week we are likely to be doing Endgame because I've seen that as well. And I couldn't really wait a whole lot longer because I've been desperate to get to the end of this. So I've watched Endgame now. We're going to talk about it and some more kind of closing things on the MCU. And then obviously, you know, in between this, we may also do Falcon and Winter Soldier because I just think... you know, that ties in perfectly to everything we're talking about right now. In between all this, we've got to get Sophie Mensah on the show. We've got to get Michael James Dee on the show. So you're going to have it all over the place lately. If you like the comic book stuff, then listen. If you don't, that's okay. Like, we get it. I do change this up but I would say, for our standpoint, from where this comes from the studio's heart, this is very much aspirational for us. We study the comic book stuff because we love comic books. I am, like, the biggest comic book geek now. You know what I mean? And I just love the intricacy of the stories and stuff like that, and have been since I was a little kid. So, you know, this is very much for you guys to get a chance to see kind of, like, the bigger aspirations we have as a studio and the bigger things we'd like to work on and why we really, I mean, if nothing else, why we really, really appreciate kind of stuff that's been going through the MCU. Just as a word on that, too, because this is another good example that the MCU has been quintessentially amazing, in my view. And we were just talking about this, talking about all the director's commentaries that are so worthwhile to listen to, and picking independent filmmakers that have shown their worth in other films and putting them on this huge platform and really letting them shine. I mean, it's just, I can't think of nowadays, you know, it's almost as if you've got a class now. You've got, you know, Peyton Reed, who, you know, Ant-Man and Wasp, you've got James Gunn, you've got the Russo brothers, now you've got these two, like, it's just...
Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck.
Yeah, Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, you know, and I can't think, are there any others that I've missed there that have gone through, like, the whole... Early on, they had a
James Gunn, you know, I think they've also, like, but you're right, they've also, like, incorporated people like Taika Waititi.
You
know.
Sorry, that's another really big one, Taika Waititi. I mean, Taika Waititi is so brilliant these days, I think they just let him do whatever he wants, because...
He really
hasn't had, you know, a bad film in a while, so... Yeah. But my point is, like, that is, even early Marvel wasn't necessarily doing that. Jon Favreau... he took a slight punt with, but not much of one. He's not, you know, he wasn't very indie when he did Iron Man and all those things.
But certainly he comes from that school, right? Like Swingers and
I think so. You know, like I don't know John whatsoever, but watching his films and watching the way, you know, he does his roundtables and the way he talks, like, he is part of the... You know, we spend a lot of time talking about the shitty part of Hollywood, okay? And I would have fully admit that. And that's because when I lived out there, like, I wasn't working in the biz, but I was hanging out with a lot of people from the biz, and you just meet some not-so-cool people. You know what I mean? People
who are very... And it's inevitable, right?
Yeah, people who are very, you know, interested in image versus quality, people who are more interested in the money and the fame than they are in the art. Like, that's the people I was around, kind of, you know, like, not a ton either. It's not like I don't want to make it seem like I hang out with, like, a you know, a rogues gallery from James Bond. But the good side that I know of is all this other stuff with the Jon Favreau's of the world, because these are networks of people that recognize talent in the filmmaking world and really try to nurture that. And, you know, taking this slightly outside the MCU but sticking with Disney, if you watch all the behind the scenes on The Mandalorian, you'll really get a sense of what we're talking about with that. But, you know, just in this case, so talking about Captain Marvel today, and I guess we're going to spin a little bit into talking about, you know, amazing directors and how this all works, but I would just encourage you, if you are an MCU fan, you're listening to this podcast, and you're like, wow, I want to know more, all the behind-the-scenes stuff, I would say, from Black Panther, maybe even Thor Ragnarok onwards, is really good at giving you the detail of the filmmaking, and all of the director's commentaries are worthwhile. Aside from, and this is no slight on Joe Johnson, I just didn't find your commentary particularly interesting, but that was the only director's commentary on Captain America: The First Avenger that I was like, oh, like, okay.
Yeah, sometimes you listen to commentaries and you can tell that the person doing it is like, oh, this is a great opportunity to kind of, you know, explain things. And there are others that are like, I don't see the point in this, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, and I think that's part of the cool thing about listening to all these commentaries. You know, it's been in, 18 films with all the commentaries through, and it's interesting because some, like Ed has pointed out before, are really good at them, and other people just don't know what to say. And either way...
This is the first time that I'd listened to a commentary for a really long time. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, a long time.
Well, why do you...
And, you know, it was one of the things that... You know, we talk about the Lord of the Rings, the special edition DVDs and stuff, and that was one of the things that I absolutely, like, absorbed. I listened to, like, 4 different commentary tracks, and I listened to all of them and stuff.
Yeah, I definitely think it's interesting to me, because, for me, I look at all that stuff as a teaching tool, and before that, it was a fan tool, and it's kind of interesting to see how the crossover happens with that, right? That something that acts as, like, fanfare, you know, all that... extended Lord of the Rings and all of that good stuff. That was hours and hours of footage put together for fans. But, you know, again, if you're an aspiring filmmaker, this is what what Ed and I laughed about. I said, it's keys to the kingdom there, really. Like, you know, if you studied it enough, you'd get all the details you needed to kind of figure out how these scenes were made, because the Peter Jackson just thought that was a necessary evil to what he was doing.
And one of the things I think I appreciated the most about this one, again, the directors Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, was that they come from, like, a very indie background.
Very much so, yeah.
And you could tell there were, like, moments when they were like, oh, this is a real kind of pinch me moment, when I realized I was on a great, you know, giant film and stuff like that. And I just really like those moments.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about that, you know, Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck a bit. You know, Ryan Fleck stood out to me because he's Tish, and I love just about anybody that comes out of Tish. I almost wish I went to Tish myself. Tish is the arts.
That was my kind of goal when I wanted to go to film school.
It was Ryan, right? I can't remember. I think it was Ryan, not Anna, that went to Tish. But one of the two of them went to Tish, and you can see it in their work. Like, Tish is where Scorsese went. Like, these are the kind of the cream of the crop out of New York film school. You can see this if you watch some of their stuff. Now, Ed has recommended one of their old ones, which is called Half Nelson. That, I mean, I haven't watched it personally, but I've heard it is quintessentially a film that will make you fall really in love with Ryan Gosling. I think it has echoes of The Basketball Diaries, from what I can tell from what it's describing.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. When it was first described to me, it was, oh, it's a heartwarming story about a teacher who's a crackhead. And I was like, what? And that just kind of made me want to watch it. But... yeah, it was really, really cool, and it was, I think it was their first film. I think Ryan kind of directed it, and Anna produced it, but that was kind of one of their first films, and it's great.
And this is sweet and
warm.
And they definitely, you know, just like James Gunn did in the past. Now, we always say these guys came out of nowhere. It's not like they came out of nowhere. Mm. A lot of them grind on the indie circuit for quite a while. So this one, I noticed that, you know, Half Nelson's 2006, guys, and they don't get nominated to take Captain Marvel until 2017. So they spent 11 years kind of, and they had lots of good successes. You know, obviously the intro, so the short film concept they did, and this is showing you how that works in real life, the short film concept that they did for Half Nelson won an award at Sundance, and that was part of the reason they got propelled into the limelight.
Right.
You know, the other interesting thing to read about the two of them, if you want to research them online, is kind of how they've developed their working relationship, because apparently they didn't get along very well at the beginning. They just knew they worked well together. And so they had to kind of sort out egos and everything like that along the way. Nowadays, they say it's not a problem in the slightest, but I was really, you know, interested to see that, because it is becoming another thing that is, I wouldn't say incredibly common, but Ed and I work this way now. You know, it wasn't always this way with Ed and I, but Ed and I have kind of become co-directors on things, because when we do a project, it's very hard for us now to separate out, well, who's producing and who's directing this bit and who's doing that and who's doing that. So you see a lot of these co-directors coming about.
Basically, Jason was like, okay, I want to direct. Like, get out of my way. And I was like, oh, cool. Fine.
Forceful in my approach. So, but, I mean, it's a really interesting thing. What do you think, Ed, this adds to the film? So, again, you know, setting the stage, and you're good at setting the stage, so maybe spend 2 minutes, just 2 minutes, setting the stage in what is Captain Marvel, and why do Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck add to this as a Marvel movie and as their own kind of director stamp on it?
Right, right. Okay, so Captain Marvel is the first female-led Marvel movie, right? And that I think that's important to know for context, because I think it's something that for a long time was like, well, why hasn't Scarlett Johansson gotten a Black Widow movie, or why, you know, why hasn't this happened earlier? And so there was a lot of expectation for it.
Hmm.
Now, they hired these two directors who I always think it's fascinating, and again, we often go back to the whole Edgar Wright, Ant-Man kind of situation, just because it's a very interesting, I think it's a point of inflection where Marvel kind of and Kevin Feige were like, okay, we need everyone who works on our films need to understand that they're making a Marvel film,
mm-hmm.
and they're not making a them film, right? And I don't think that's an ego thing. I think it's just, again, kind of part of this, you know, like general aesthetic and style and stuff like that. But I think that one of the things that they have really done a great job is in giving opportunities to young up-and-coming filmmakers, and this is a good example. Now, what do they bring to this particular film? I think that, and they kept referencing it in the commentary, every time there's a real-world location, the way it's shot is really interesting. It's not like by the numbers, it's not like, you know, there's, like, I think about the scene in when she goes to meet Maria Rambeau, and they're in the bar together,
mm-hmm.
and it's just a scene in a bar, right? And also when she's speaking to Nick Fury in the bar for the first time. It's just a simple scene in a bar.
The one that the directors talked about was closer to the end where she's leaving. They have that scene where they're all talking out in the, because this was filmed in Louisiana, which is beautiful.
Mm.
And so you get in the commentary, you get a lot of talks about how difficult it is to film in Louisiana, which, you know, people can tell you that because there's a lot of things alive in Louisiana in the heat.
Yeah, the cicadas. Cicadas in Korea. And
I can tell you about cicadas. They're very famous in Cincinnati, where I come from, because they come back every 17 years and take over the town. It's a bit, cicadas are interesting. That's really a whole different topic. But the scene I'm talking about is close to the end. You have, I think it's right after she picks her colors with the little Rambo.
Monica.
Rambo. The one who becomes, you know, that was awesome. Monica. That's later in WandaVision now is the person we've been watching. So.
It makes you appreciate this film even more.
Definitely. And I'll talk a little bit how that all connects together if you want. You know what I mean? If you want me to kind of connect the dots, because there's something that happened in WandaVision that's going to show you a little bit how this all plays into the Captain Marvel storyline, which we're talking about. But going back to the directors and what Ed's talking about at the scenes, look at... It's not a steady cam scene, and I was surprised about this because you can see the camera movement, like the slight camera jerks that they were panning outside. They had all the characters involved, so you have the Skrull, the lead Skrull, who's played by a wonderful actor, Talos.
Yes, Ben Mendelsohn.
Ben Mendelsohn. Yeah, yeah. So he's talking, you know, the older Rambo is talking, Captain Marvel, and they're all in like a circle outside, and the camera's panning to each one, and... In the commentary, what they're pointing out is, like, we stripped everything from this scene. We didn't want to be anything more than a camera and people talking. And that seems to be where we have done exceedingly well on this one. They won't recognize because it gives it a really... Even though you've got guys in makeup, because this guy's in full prosthetic, it gives it a really... Because the camera's not straight. Like, it's bobbing a little bit because someone's holding it.
It's organic almost.
Exactly.
Right?
So it gives you this... It's real.
It gives a sense of reality.
It reminds me a bit of the found footage stuff that you had with Chronicle, because that's why Chronicle worked, and Cloverfield was the other one where that really works, because all of a sudden you feel like you're getting in close to something you normally wouldn't. Like, I think that was one of the hardest things to do in this film. So Captain Marvel as a character in MCU is incredibly powerful. Like, one of the most powerful characters, like the Scarlet Witch, you wouldn't understand just how powerful she is.
So they kind of had
a double whammy with putting this together, and Feige knew this. So that's why, first he knew this was going to be the first female-led MCU, as Ed was saying. And that is why if you go through like the articles on this, there was a long history of them looking at different female directors. But, you know, I really have to applaud Disney with this one and Kevin especially, because it's the kind of thing where you could tell just by the search that they did that they weren't looking for a token director. And that's not to say the people they had before were token directors, but they really went to town with talking about, we think the story is going to go this way, so is this something you can live with? And two of the previous directors were like, well, no, that's not really where I saw things going.
So they come off the project. One of the things that they mentioned talking about with Kevin Feige was the idea of female friendship and that being so central to the story. You know, the friendship between Carol and Maria, and Carol and Mar-Vell, you know, played by the wonderful Annette Bening. So it definitely like had a theme, and it really kind of stuck to it really
definitely hard. And when we talked about this a little bit earlier, because I've been calling Ed incessantly lately because it's COVID and I'm really bored, so sorry Ed, I do bug you on a regular basis with all this crap, but point being, when we talked about this earlier, Ed was saying like, I liked Captain Marvel, but obviously it's not my favorite of the bunch. And he was asking me, he's like, do you think there's ever a point where someone, you know, looks at this, and we were kind of, you know, under our breath saying a male, you know, would look at this and say like, it's a boring superhero film like everything else. And indeed,
I did that.
No, and
the first time I watched it, I did that.
It's like, absolutely fine.
Like, it doesn't connect with me.
Indeed, many of the reviews that were male driven were, oh, this is just a superhero film. There's nothing to it. Like, and I told Ed, like, I disagree slightly. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I agree this is a superhero film, and it does have those cookie cutter elements where we have an origin story and we have a superhero coming about from that. The two things that are really different here, what Ed has pointed out, you know, one is this friendship, the girls, like, going through time kind of deal, and the bonds that are kept over time, and like the lines that like
it and was, that's part of the comic books as well, right? Like that's quite a central
very much so because that's books. Very much Stan Lee. I mean, this is why we all love Stan Lee. Stan Lee was a man, you know, and please, you know, if I'm wrong about this, correct me in the comments, but as far as I've seen I read old comics now, or I read the best ones, the ones that are coming out from like 2000, for most recently 2020, that have like little clips of what Stan used to say in his comic books. So they'll have this like article from Stan's column section, right? And all of a sudden it will have this section that says, you know, oh, by the way, you know, I want to point out that this is what a racist looks like. And he spends a whole page just going on about how race will never, you know, racism will never be part of his comic books. He felt the same way about women's rights. I mean, this was a guy who used comic books through children and successfully, if you look at the way we are now, successfully now to kind of say, oh, you know, we need to make some changes.
That's why I can't understand people who say our comic books are evil and, you know, you shouldn't read comic books. Because they went through that, like, in the 50s or, like, at some point, right?
I don't know. There's always been a question about the violence in comic books. And that comes from usually the same sex they always come from in America, with that Puritan element where they don't, you know, it's the influencing of things that make people into it. I mean, I always, from day one, I've always thought that was a bogus argument to begin with. So, but who knows? I mean, you did have Crazy Man shoot up a bunch of people because he thought he was a Joker. Oh. But that's like the worst I've ever seen.
And there was like also something that happened recently, wasn't there? Like a couple of weeks ago, and then like just the other day. Like,
yeah, no, there's been, in America, there's been 8 shootings in 8 weeks. But I blame that on COVID, mate. That's, you know, people stuck in their houses and lots of guns about. So,
One thing I did want to say, which came up like super early in the film, because it's one of my first notes, but they did 55 setups in one day. I was like, oh my god, these guys are indie. These guys are so indie. Like
Which scene was that? It was an action scene we were talking about with that. Which one was it?
It was very, very early on. And I remember they...
Cause that's
they
were right. So it's when...
Giving some love to... I think it's like...
this was part of the stuff with all of Jude Law and his group that goes around. Because this starts out... Captain Marvel, the only... And I wouldn't make it a criticism. I'm just not sure... Mm. The story flow worked for me this way, although obviously I saw how it worked. This one's a bit weird. You will have watched it by now, I'm assuming. So if not, stop it now and go back and watch it. But I'm not sure I agreed, and they talked about this, like, I'm not sure I agreed with the opening her being on a completely different side.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Especially
yeah.
MCU, because we have seen the Kree enough to know that the Kree are not good people. And so...
Yeah, yeah. Like, I got what they were saying. I got, like, their thinking on it. But I agree. I'm not sure that it was
necessarily the right choice. They talked about it at the beginning, they said, well, listen, we had some inklings earlier on that this was all a trap and that they had actually kidnapped her and she didn't know. You know, because this is what you find out about halfway through the film, is that she's actually not Kree at all. She's, you know, was stolen... you know, from the States, and she's been injected with this core bit, which is what gave her this monstrous, huge amount of powers, and the Kree are being who they always are, controlling and manipulative, you know what I mean? So, do you know what I mean? Like, I just, because I'd seen all the other ones, I was like, wait a second, like, why are we back with the Kree again, and blah, 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 but a small point, really, like, you know, nothing big, I just, and I don't know whether when they wrote it, it looked like the pacing just worked better that way.
Well, because they talked about not wanting to introduce Ronan too early, because anyone who'd watched the Guardians would be like, oh, he was the bad guy in the Guardians, so if they're working. During, they were trying to kind of keep up the mystery thing, which again, I kind of got. But the scene where they go, where she gets captured by the Skrulls, you know, where they go down to the planet and...
Yeah, and she's hanging upside down and whatnot, yeah.
But before that, like, when they're actually, like, you know, doing the mission, the Navy SEALs.
I think that was close to the 55 setups discussion,
But they talked about how they shot in a quarry, like, night shoots and all this stuff, and... I don't know, it was kind of cool, and it made me think, man, I kind of really want to try one of those, because, you know, there's obviously, you know, we talk about the Lord of the Rings, but Helm's Deep is, like, the famous one, which is, like, going to war. Like, you know, 20 days of night shoots in the rain, like, in the mud.
That's right, so, like, I think...
That'd be cool, that'd be kind of fun.
I think you
shooting
start...
a quarry.
No, definitely, and I think you definitely... you get onto a theme here, and what Ed's talking about is, like... If you go back through some of our previous podcasts that talk about MCU and indie directors, is there is a direct correlation between the difficult stuff you do to get your indie film. So when we talk about like Benson and Moorhead, or even going back to Benny Loves You, you know, when you talk about the detail-driven stuff that you have to do that is arduous, and it's the stuff that distinguishes good indie film versus crap indie film. You know, someone who didn't take the time is not generally going to have, you know, either not quality sound or whatever it is. I think that's why you can import someone like that and put it into a bigger production, because honestly, like, it's the same process, it's just with a much bigger team.
Right, and I think there is an adaptation element, you know, just because, like, and she even says it at the end, I think Anna says it, where she talks about they'd never worked on a crew this big with so many people and stuff like that. So there is, you know, that to contend with, but I think that if you can handle that and you can apply that kind of indie pixie dust to it, you know, whether it's through attention to detail or just the way you approach things by not using so many sound stages, using more real locations like they did, you know, it just makes it more interesting than that, oh, it's just a kind of superhero thing, which I get the criticism at the time. I think it was, for me, it was wrapped up in the fact that it came after like Black Panther and Thor Ragnarok and Infinity War, which were just, like, so good. Like, that's probably kind of my favorite trifecta in the MCU thus far. And you know, I think it's... outside of that context, I think this film is fantastic. But just in that context, in that time, I didn't quite enjoy it as much.
No, that's absolutely fine. I just think... You know, I the correlation is just interesting to me, and I would say it's a quality control thing, and maybe that's why what they're looking for in directors and whatnot. You know, in the background, you've got, you know, some other very much bigger guys kind of doing stuff early on in Marvel, but really, you know, you think about the level of detail that has made these films interesting to people, and I think that does squarely come from the same things you have to worry about in the indie world. You know, that whole, like, does it look good? Does it have all the elements I need it to? And then I guess what you're getting extra with the indie directors is the other thing you have to do in indie that I don't think you have to do in a big blockbuster, you know, which makes it interesting for this discussion, is put that kind of quirky stamp on it. Indie, you can never, unless, you know, there is no fanfare for indie. You know what I mean? If you want an indie film to be watched, it has to have something about it to watch. So you're not going to get the tentpole. Yeah. You know, oh, by the way, it's just a superhero film. Right.
There isn't just the guarantee that it's going to open in this many theaters.
That's right. Or that people would just want to go see it because of the nature of what it is, you know, because it's a superhero film or it's a horror film or whatever. So this is what I mean. Like, I think that gives you that extra oomph that you need to kind of say, well, this is what makes me unique. And that's where Disney is able to kind of hand select. They've done it again on Star Wars as well, taking different personality points that come through. And as I said, the easiest example for me is Taika Waititi, because I don't think you can watch Taika Waititi without seeing him in
knowing
it.
That
you can't separate him from his films anymore. And that's the sign of, you know, that those are those great directors, those 12 that are in that book we talked about. Yeah,
it's kind of the auteur thing. But again, I think that it's a different muscle to work with a Marvel. Like, it's and that's why for me Taika's kind of the king of the hill at the minute. Simply because he's able to still be himself and still make a Taika Waititi film while still playing in the Marvel sandbox.
Absolutely.
But I have a question for you.
Okay.
Because this was something that I wanted to talk to you like since the moment I saw it. So after like all the action, she's captured. So once she finally arrives on Earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
You start with the like nostalgia stuff, right? Mm-hmm. She lands in the Blockbuster. There's like a Radio Shack or something. Like, did the 90s stuff work for you?
Well, it's interesting. I got a long answer for that one because it also goes into it. Kind of talking. Because one of the other things I was going to talk about when we were talking about why, because I'm not trying to be contradictory, Eddie, he might think I am right now, but I don't think the transition is as different from indie directing to Marvel directing as we're making out. And I think that's why it works so well. I think.
Okay.
On a directing level, I think you have less people to talk to, but you still have the same amount of decisions you have to make. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you're going to have departments and things like that, right? So I guess the difference becomes between having to know the art yourself. You have to trust that art guy is going to do it. But I guess my point is the difference would be the money that you have when you're making these studio films as well, right? And one of the big things that was interesting about the 90s look is how they tried for so long to get it right. And this is where, you know, in an indie world, you would have never had the process they went through. But because they had money, you know, they started by using, I can't remember what cameras it was now, but they started by using one set of cameras. And then they didn't like the way those looked. And they were like, well, no. And then they tried to fit new lenses onto it because they were using Arri for this one. This was all formed on an Arri Alexa.
Where did you read this? This is really interesting.
This is all on the Wikipedia page.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So if you go down to the production, when they talk about production of this. So they tried to get Arri lenses, and this is why Ed should definitely read it, because he'd probably understand it better than I did. But they tried to get Arri lenses fitted that would work to give it more of a 90s haze, as it were. And it just didn't work. Yeah. And so they had to special commission, as opposed to using older lenses, they had to special commission a bunch of lenses just to be used for this production.
And that's
the kind of thing that, like, normally I'd be furious about that, but I'm like, if they felt... That was what to do. That's where you have to trust your indie people, now big people. And that's why I trust that more than I trust, you know, another, and I'm not going to name any director names here, but there are plenty of directors on the big circuit, and Ed knows because I just talked about one today incessantly, that just waste money. You know what I mean? That just because, you know, the example that got me, and I love the guy as a director, Peter Jackson, but Peter Jackson had this moment in The Hobbit, right? That I'll never forget, because the producer in me was screaming when he told me this. So because you watch the behind the scenes, there are seven.
Wait, he told you this?
Yeah, he did. He was speaking straight to me in the director's commentary.
I love that. That's how you see it. I love it.
And I have mentioned this, I believe, on one of our very much older podcasts, but there's a scene where, like, you're watching them do the goblin stuff, and he's got nine guys, and he's trained his goblins, and he's dressed them all up as them, and they're really excited, and they all do their goblin thing, and then we pan to, like, a week later, because that's how the behind-the-scenes goes with Lord of the Rings, with The Hobbit, you're literally there for every bit of it, and Peter like completely changes his mind, gets rid of the eight actors and CGs the whole thing for a boatload of money. And it's just...
You've told this story a couple of times.
Oh, a couple of times, because...
Which I love. It's definitely, like, the one example for you where it's like, no!
Yeah, no, I just, and it is the one example, because there it's like, I don't, listen, it didn't look any better with the goblins in CGI, and that's the point. Like, that's wasted money, and why is that wasted money? Well, you have to go back to, like, the Transcendence podcast for that. That is money off your bottom line, you know what I mean? Like, fine if you make a film for $140 million, but if you're only going to gross $160 million, wow, that's an awful lot of money to put up for a $20 million game, you know what I mean?
You have to start
thinking, like, Avengers-style, where Endgame reaches a billion, you know what I mean? Like, a billion. So if that costs $350 million to make, you still made three times your money in the end. You know, Captain Marvel, I think, was a similar story. I don't have the production figures in front of me, but I remember it said that it produced far more, you know, than was expected.
So here's a question, because I think they must have spent so much money on this. The de-aging on Samuel L. Jackson and Clark Gregg.
Yes.
Like, how did you feel about that?
Well, it's good. See, that'll get us back to kind of the original. Because originally you asked, what do you think of the 90s cameras? And what I didn't get out on that was, unfortunately, and I do feel unfortunate on this, because I think it was the right call if they felt it was the right call, but I didn't notice anything specifically great about the 90s. Like, I got the Street Fighter reference. I got a couple of the other references.
Oh, what was the Street Fighter reference?
Street Fighter 2 Champion Edition. It's right in, I can't remember where it is. Oh,
is it like in one of the scenes?
It's in one of the bars. It's what they play.
I do remember that.
You know, and so, like, I got the kind of the references and the throwbacks, and like, kind of but it really wasn't overtly 90s to me. The only one I really remember that they were talking about in the director's commentary was, like, the loading screen, and that was just stupid to me, to be honest. Like, it was like, okay, we get it.
Yeah, like, I know what you mean. It was, it, like, I kind of wanted to get excited. Even the song choices that they made, like, they had Waterfalls in there.
Then I have to eat my words, because you just point out the soundtrack and I completely forgot about that. So, yes, the only thing I would say that, obviously, because it's me.
I'm Just a Girl.
Man. Like, yeah, those are like, and you can hear them talking about how hard it was for them to set up into different things, but I love it. The choices on that were amazing. You know what I mean? To have.
I was like, oh, okay, cool. But I don't know why it wasn't. I don't know. My example is always Stranger Things when it comes to nostalgia, right? Like, they, particularly in, like, season one, they did a nostalgia that was, like, just subtle enough that it really did feel. Maybe it's also because it was the 80s, which is more my childhood.
No. I would completely agree, because I would say that this one, like, this is the thing. To me, they put up a lot more money than they were trying to for how subtle it was. I liked how subtle it was. I liked the music was really the only thing that kept really taking me back and being like, oh, God, I forgot how much I love this era in music. You know what I mean? Like,
So it worked for you.
Yeah, that with the music, it worked. I mean, again, the amount of money spent on, you know, the new lenses, because I just, every time you hear the word lenses, it's like, how much were those?
I got a, you know, one of those Facebook memories of, like, stuff that you post and stuff, and it was the meme, which is, like, the it's someone crying, and underneath it said, no one understands how expensive lenses
are. Oh my God, no, you don't. I
feel it every time. Oh my God. So, yeah, imagine getting custom-made lenses.
For Aries, for big old Aries. You need a bunch of them, because it's...
And they used, I think it's called a photon, the phantom, sorry, the super high speed for, you know, when she gets her powers the thing, like, explodes and stuff. This, like, super high frame, high speed thing, which I think worked really nicely. It was a cool effect. Okay, I have another question, though.
Well, I didn't answer your first one, to be honest, so I can answer that one.
Okay.
Because you were asking...
I thought that you said you it worked for you.
The 90s one worked, because then you were asking about Sam Jackson and I would say, and I'll just be quick about that one, Ed, but you know, we talked about this. We didn't do a podcast on, what was it, The Irishman, but we talked about it before. Like, how much money, because that was like, what was that, $200 million, which $150 million of that was just...
I don't know if that's accurate, but I mean, you know, the hyperbole
The hype said that there was, I mean, again, that was hype, but it said it was a huge proportion of that budget was the de-aging. So again, if that's the case here, this was, if I remember correctly from the research I did this morning, like $170 million, so... If $70 million of that or $50 million of that went to the CGI, can I be honest? Like, because I love Sam L. Jackson, I loved it.
Yeah.
Like, that was a really good twist. And that's when Ed and I were talking a little bit before about Kevin Feige. And how this compares up, because, you know, I'll just be honest. The person I was bashing earlier today was Zack Snyder, because I hate the fact that he's...
We were talking the recent release of the Snyder.
I have, right? like Rise of Skywalker type feelings with it. I just don't... 40...
I think we should do a podcast.
40 million for a four-hour cut.
You should have to watch it.
Like, listen, if anybody actually in film is listening to this, like, that is not the way I do business. And it like, literally makes me want to retch to think that 40 million...
But stay focused. Stay focused.
No, because now I'm about to retch.
But if you were in charge here, if you had like the you know, the money strings, would you be like,
okay? Yes, but that's how this comes about, and that's why I want to talk about it, because nothing happens in a vacuum, and that's what Wikipedia page on this is really helpful. And I did some jumping off from that page to do more research, but I tell you, it'll show you how this whole thing with Sam Jackson came about, right? So Sam Jackson originally not in the Captain Marvel story, you know, not in the script,
no way, really.
Not one of the things. And then they start making casting decisions, and whether people realize it or not, Brie Larson is one of the last people that is cast on this. They can't figure out who they want as Captain Marvel. Mm. They're also considering who they want for Miss Marvel.
Didn't they have like just some random actress stand in on a Avengers Infinity War scene, because they didn't know who they were going to cast? Like, that's a thing, right? I remember seeing that.
That I don't know. I didn't read that, but it crazy, very well, man. Could be. But, yeah, so, yeah. Brie Larson is a big fan of Sam Jackson, and convinced Kevin that it would be good to bring him in because he hasn't had his own kind of protagonist thing.
I already love her. I love her even more.
Well, I mean, you should. Brie Larson, like, you know, Ed was like, she's remember amazing. Her? I'm like, of course I remember Clash at Demon Head. Thank you very much. Apparently her work on Kong Skull
Island... His favorite movie of all time.
Oh, man. Well, she plays...
Scott Pilgrim. If you haven't heard that podcast, make sure you go
plays,
listen to it.
She plays Envy in that. So, I mean, that is just... When she comes out on stage, man, it's electric. You know, that is like one of my favorite
songs.
And
I was telling you about her performance in, I think it's called Room.
That's right.
She won an Oscar.
And so this comes about from her work with... Is it Gareth Edwards that's doing Kong Skull Island? You know, there's this whole metaverse now for the Godzilla and Kong stuff. And Sam Jackson and Brie Larson were both in... the Kong
that's
one,
right,
Skull Island. And so she used that, and she said, listen, I've worked with this guy before, I'm telling you, like, you should do this nostalgia bit, they'll love it. So,
that's so cool.
And what gets me is, like, I'm not sure a director or a writer would have ever thought of that, because the problem I had, and I told Ed this, the problem I had with de-aging Sam L. Jackson is the Sam L. Jackson he plays is not Sam L. Jackson in the 90s. I was a big fan of him in the 90s for Die Hard with a Vengeance and with Pulp Fiction. And he was always a swearing, sharp-talking, old-looking, you know, that guy. And so...
He hasn't really changed. I feel like he hasn't really
changed. Exactly, exactly.
It feels a little bit like a waste of money.
Sam Jackson now is as scary as he was, you know, 10, 20 years ago in the 90s. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. But then they make him into this kind of like... cutesy cuddly guy, like the cat bit. I couldn't get over how much I love the Flurkin, because it was like,
yes,
it
the
just
Flurkin was amazing.
It turns him that in the time he sings the Marvelettes is just my two favorite moments of the movies, because you get that, right? And you wouldn't get that otherwise. If no one had suggested, hey, let's put Sam in this and let's make him like young, and let's make him like him and Phil will be really young characters. And that's what I mean. I don't think that was ever the original intention.
I love seeing Phil Coulson, by the way. Like,
I know.
You know, all those seasons of Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Wonderful, right?
Like, yes.
And it was an opportunity, just like we're going to talk about in Endgame, and no spoilers for Endgame, but there, you're going to have people come back in Endgame. That is the spoiler. Mm. Sorry, spoiler for Endgame. Mm. If you haven't watched it by now, you know, everyone's been spoiling it for me for like a decade, it feels like. So here's my spoiler to you. They bring back some people. You know what I mean? Like... Mm. But that was kind of like why this works so close to the end, because it's this wrap-up episode that really isn't, because it takes place, what, 10 years before the wrap-up?
Right, which is interesting.
Or 30 years before the wrap-up.
Can we talk Skrulls?
Sure.
How like, they're an awesome bad guy, right? Like, I know nothing about... I know, like, that they appear in Secret Wars or something like that, and... I know very little else, but they make great bad guys, right? What did you feel about the twist you know, the like, ah, they're not actually the bad guys.
Well, and I see, that's the thing. I think that has nothing to do with the Skrulls themselves and more to do with your directors, because they were the ones tasked mm-hmm. with, and there's those scenes for that. So that's where the director's commentary again on this is really helpful for those of you with Disney Plus. Like,
that was some good moments.
Watch that scene where they go back to, so there's a scene where, and God, lab. can I just shout out here, because I just think she's awesome. Like, I'm sorry, it's really weird for me because I only catch her here and there, but Annette Bening. God damn. Yeah, yeah. Like, it's like Michelle Pfeiffer. Every time I see you in something, I'm like, I forgot that you're just amazing as an actress. Like,
I'm going to go so far as to say that I feel she was a little wasted in this. Is that fair? Because she's also the kind of AI intelligence, and she's really good in that. Like, I don't know. I feel like I could have done with more Annette Bening, but
I think
so. Like,
I think what they're doing with that, though, especially, again, going to some things we'll talk about more in Endgame, but the really cool thing about the MCU, Ed, is how they used these older celebrities. And I don't mean that in the saying Annette Bening, that anything's lacking on you. You know what I mean? Like, you looked gorgeous. Same with Michelle Pfeiffer. You know?
Oh, my God.
I hope you're not listening kind of deal. You know what I mean? Like,
no.
I couldn't believe
beautiful,
it.
Beautiful, talented, just like
glowing
just on screen.
But like, and they did this with Michael Douglas as well. Like, all of those characters, aside from Sam Jackson, and even maybe except for this particular movie, Sam Jackson, they have all been given supplementary roles. And I really like that, because it's like, no, the Marvel superheroes have to be new actors, new actresses, people that are
right.
And that's not me trying to be ageist about it at all. It's just, it's helping people get
to grips
with this.
They need to connect with the younger audience.
Yes,
because
I think, like, one of the biggest fallacies you have with all these reboots of anything is taking a character that was popular in the 80s and just not updating them or not changing them, and using the same actor is even worse. Not because there's anything wrong with that actor or actress, it's just you have to understand that people watching it now are going to be a greater group of people than were watching it in the 80s. So you've got to make sure that you're not...
So are you not down for Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield, like, showing up in...
No, totally down for that. I'm just saying, like, the good thing that they do is you can have them in to have the camera pan to them, but the camera should focus on Brie Larson. The camera should always back to Brie Larson,
like, okay,
Sam Jackson.
Right, it's okay to wink and nod and be like, hey, like, it's amazing to have these, but that's, you know, this is about a new
generation. Yeah, because that's where these directors are showing this stuff, because that's the marriage between the story and the camera, okay? Like, the camera is supposed to follow the protagonist, and if it follows either too many protagonists or people that aren't as important, because in real life they're more celebrity-based, this is where, in my view, you get into huge toxic fandom problems with stories, you know? Like, where things just go all awry because you've put in, you know, someone who's too old to be the character, or something that just wouldn't work. In this case, every time they used an older actor that you knew was going to be dynamite, but you're like, ooh, would I give them as a superhero? They put it in perfectly. You know, it's just that subtle.
I hate to bring it up again, but I mean, like, Star Wars, right? Like, this is kind of, it didn't work there. They didn't get the balance right, whereas here...
Well, that's right.
I feel like they did.
Okay, so going back to my arguments with Rise of Skywalker, because again, as you're finding out, people, there's only a few things in life that I can really detest, but when I do, I'm really detest them. I'm
this
like,
is one of them.
This is one of those things that just bugs me. So the reemergence of Palpatine, you know what I mean? It was just so poor. It was like, why not have someone new do this? We've had all this time with Kylo Ren, and I thought his story was awesome. Like, I just thought the whole progression there, but it all gets muddied because instead of pushing forward, which is what you're always supposed to do, you hamper back and say, well, we don't want to offend those people in the 80s or the 70s that watched Star Wars and wanted it to end this way. Like, sorry, but they're not the only people that are watching Star Wars anymore.
No, and I always appreciate when directors and producers and writers do that kind of thing, but I want, like, new stuff, you know? But getting back to Skrulls... Can you tell me about Skrulls? Like,
No. Like, that's probably why I was dancing around the question, because I know that obviously they're a major part of Secret Wars, which is supposed to be one of the potential future big
shows,
plots that they're going to plots that they're going to unveil.
Okay.
Because it's it's a mini series.
Okay, but how do you feel about the shapeshifter? Because there were some really cool sequences, like, I'm thinking
that's
about
right.
The,
so getting back to what we were talking about,
the train chase.
I got distracted by Annette Bening. Sorry about that. But getting back to that scene where they go back onto, and it is, Annette Bening's not even in the scene, but it's where they go back to her station, and you have all the mothers and daughters come out, and then they do this thing with the, like, you know, where...
It's like a Maori kind of...
Yeah, and it's where the story writing helps, because in other words, like, if you would have done it in a normal way, it's less noticeable. When you do it in a way that's alien, all of a sudden you pay particular attention to the affection they're giving to one another, and that helps you disregard the pointy ears and the nose. Mm. Like, I think that's the perfect blend. Like, you had to give him the pointy ears and the nose.
Can I be honest, though, and just kind of say, in that moment, I was like, oh, but, like, you know, why are we assuming that aliens have, like, you know, children, like, mother, father, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it was one of those silly moments where you kind of get pulled out for some stupid reason. And, just in that moment.
No, it's what we call the Star Trek argument. So one of the huge complaints about Star Trek is that everything appears to be humanoid. And so it's why if we're traveling all over the distant galaxies in the universe, is everybody look like that? And then Star Wars has less of that.
I read a Star Trek book where they kind of explain that.
Yeah, I mean, like, who knows?
They actually went so far as to, like, kind of, you know, give it an explanation.
So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. It wasn't a problem for me, especially because it was MCU, so that's the kind of thing they're always going to do. Like, why does everybody understand each other? Like, that's the other thing that's really weird, you know what I mean? Like,
right, everyone speaks English.
You know.
What about the scene on the train? Like, fighting with the old woman and that whole...
I love the director's commentary on that, which pointed out that there was some, what was it, the security guard for Marvel was cast in that, and they gave him a really hard...
That was at the Blockbuster.
What happens on the train? Who's on the... Oh, no. The stunt double and her sister are fighting each other.
Yes, that's right. So
that's what's happening on the train. I love stuff like that. It's the same reason I love Ant-Man, because, again, it's using the camera to tell the story, and that's a big deal to me now. Like, that's the best way to do it. So, and that's why you need these types of filmmakers, the ones that can not just see, oh, the story should go this way, the one that sees story should go this way, so let's do this with the camera to indicate to the audience that this is what we're doing. And so, yeah, I mean...
Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was real good that way.
But I'm talking about, like, the scroll... Like, I just like the, you know, the idea of, like, getting lost in a crowd, like, the chase, and I think that it makes the shapeshifter just a cool bad guy, and I'm excited for, you know, future things. And I like them, and Ben Mendelsohn was freaking amazing.
Yeah, I think without Ben Mendelsohn, then you have a problem with the Skrull, because he...
I did like the science guy, though. I thought he was quite funny.
But again, it was humanizing them. Wasn't that so human when they're like, you're supposed to be my science guy?
Yeah. And he's like, what's up? He's like, oh, sorry.
My bad. But that's what I mean. Like, it was all those elements. Ben Mendelsohn, probably the best example of that, because the speech that he gives when he first comes into that room.
Yes.
That is the one where all this, you know, where he just, you know, he cuts it in half, basically. He reveals the story to you and says, actually, this is what you thought. And that is, you know, you could have heard that in a variety of different ways. Like, that's the same message we would hear from...
Doesn't he have, like, a drink as well? Like, isn't he, like, sipping from, like, a gulp or something?
He has a milkshake. So there's a discussion, and apparently that's a throwback to Quentin Tarantino. But he's sipping a Reservoir Dogs, actually.
Reservoir Dogs, that's right.
According to what they say. But I think that's the whole point. Like, as long as you keep the Skrulls from being just absolutely... It was part of the problems you had with Guardians of the Galaxy, with all the different races, is that you didn't really know anything about all these different races. They all had different colors, and so you were like, oh, okay. But especially, like, it's the only... When they said, when the Russo brothers says, oh, we're not going back to, and I can't remember the name of the capital, but the capital, because everyone knows what's happened there.
Yeah, the Nova Corps.
Zandar, right. Part of me was like, I really wish we could have just had maybe even just a side episode on Zandar, so I could have understood a little bit more what goes on in Zandar, because I didn't really get it. Like, I got it enough for the point of an MCU movie, which is, this is the joke I always make to my daughter, who sometimes wants to watch these with me, is am I watching it in order? And it's like, well, you're 7, it doesn't matter. Like, you're not going to care, you just want to watch the fun explosions, and, you know, you have your entire basically, I'm telling you have your entire life to go through this, so, you know what I mean? Like, one watch not getting what's going on isn't going to kill you. So, but I guess that's it. With the Skrull in the right context, they work fine. And would I like to see them again? Sure. I think they could play really well into a bunch of different storylines.
Yeah.
I think the only thing you have to be careful about, you know, and this is just me feeling this personally, I never dug Marvel when it went too cosmic, when it turns into a Star Wars or a Star Trek.
Okay.
Because it's not a Star Wars or Star Trek. If I wanted to watch a science fiction something, I would go to a science fiction outlet, like Star Wars or Star Trek.
I'll be honest, though. That was one of my favorite things about The Guardians. I had no expectations, and I was like, this is an amazing sci-fi movie.
Totally the same way. Like, totally thought the cosmic stuff was the best. However, I don't want, and this is, I'm only saying this because this is where they're predicting the MCU to go. I don't want the entire MCU to lose that kind of basis on Earth and just start, you know, traveling the stars all the time. Because that just, to me, that's not the Marvel story. You know, you got to have your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. You know, that's why he's quintessential to the story, because it's, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's Tom Holland. That's why he's such a fucking great actor.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Please be in my
movies, Tom. I'm looking forward to the Uncharted one he's doing, even though, like, video game movies tend to be not great.
Well, they used to be. I mean, did anyone watch Assassin's Creed? Anyone? Did you watch it?
Anyone? Bueller?
No, seriously, because I don't know if anyone... there weren't even really enough reviews out there to be like, well, was it a good movie or not?
Yeah, I might have, but I can't remember, and that tells you, like, kind of...
Yeah.
Either how I felt about it, or how, you know, people around me were like, oh, don't bother.
All I say is this way, I love Michael Fassbender, right? You're a cool dude. Yeah, I love your movies. Man. I love you, but listen, the word whitewash comes to mind when you're playing... I mean, this is the thing about Assassin's Creed that they really could have gone to town with in today's environment, right? So Ubisoft, if you're listening to me, give me one of your franchises and I will do it, because nowadays would be perfect for an Assassin's Creed movie because we're all about telling outside mainstream stories. And when I say that, I'm generally speaking, and this isn't to offend any of my white male listeners, but I'm generally talking about stories outside of the white male experience, which, don't get me wrong, I'm partially white male myself, so I'm like, I have plenty of stories that
Well, that was kind of one of the really great things about this. Like, and again, maybe one of the reasons why I was like, well, it's not really for me. But the relationship, I loved Maria Rambeau. I thought she was really, really cool, and I enjoyed it even more having watched WandaVision and knowing that there's like repercussions to this stuff, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, and this may sound entirely trite. I don't know, you know, rip me apart in the comments if you thought so, but listen, I have a daughter, and I mean, anyone who listens to my podcast knows that I'm definitely going to raise her in a weird kind of way. You know, I'm all about her being fiercely independent. Like, I just, maybe it's because I grew up in an environment where too many women were treated as if they couldn't do things for themselves, and there was a lot of misogyny around, and not even just misogyny, but sexism in that way. Like, listen, just like Black Panther is a film that I can show to her and say, this shows you why you should be proud of your African heritage, you know what I mean? And you should be proud because this was the first superhero film that I can remember that really celebrated the amazing culture that goes undescribed in Africa. And this is one of, you know, especially Western African, they went into lots of detail on that. This Captain Marvel... Without it, you know, obviously it was hailed as this way because it comes out the same year as Wonder Woman as well. But this gives you two, not just one, maybe three perfect female, like, role models, because you have someone who is not your quintessential female leader. She's a maverick. She's a from a Top Gun. And I love that, because when have we seen female characters like that? They're always hindered from doing that. They're always told, no, you can't be that way. You have responsibilities. And this is a person saying, like, it's not about the responsibilities. It's about people are who they are. And so this is a female character who is going to come through and has been badass since day one. She doesn't have to apologize to people. She doesn't have to kind of go around asking for permission to be the way she wants to be. She's just Captain fucking Marvel. And before that, she's Carol. And so it's just something I can show to my daughter and say, this is what I'm talking to you about when I say you don't have to do, you know, you don't have to conform. You don't have to, you know, be what everybody else wants you to be. And it was the first example I could think of, at least in the MCU, where that's really true. Because even Scarlet Widow...
Have you shown this to...
Kevin? No, not yet. Not yet. Because I've only just recently watched it for the first time.
That scene where, like, it's kind of the final confrontation and stuff, and she kind of, with the AI, again... The amazing Annette Bening, there's that moment where she kind of shows her all the times where she like failed and this and that.
That's kind
and
of
then,
what.
And then hold on, let me finish.
Sure.
And then you get to see like what happens after all those times where she just fucking stands up and like does it again over and over and over again. And I thought that was a brilliant. Like you said, it came out the same year as Wonder Woman, and I must admit that the kind of World War One No Man's Land sequence for me was like, oh my god, yes. And this was also that, but I think it was a little bit diminished because I'd seen the Wonder Woman one first. I don't know if that makes sense.
I think so. Like, you know, that's the... I guess for me, that's why I'm happy with it, because I can take it out of that context. That was a year, obviously, that we were talking about female empowerment. And I get that. And, like, you know, it's hard when you're a father, because you are a guy, so you're always going to have an opinion on something. But you also, like, you know, I have to try to help my daughter, you know, and help her get by, even
and
at seven.
And there's nothing wrong with, like, two films having kind of that message.
No, not at all. I guess that's the thing, not at all. What's difficult is finding more than two films where you can
say,
because that I guess that's the point I'm making. My daughter doesn't, you know, she's seven now, so the coolest thing when your kids start getting older, they start putting out their own personality. And right now, she's obsessed with Hermione Granger. Like, Hermione Granger is everything she wants
to be.
Good
role model.
So Emma Watson, if you're ever listening, please give me a call. My daughter would love to talk. Because I try to explain that Emma Watson in real life is actually almost as cool as Hermione Granger.
That's
like,
so true.
Do you know what I mean? Such a great model for women. You know what I mean?
Badass. Yeah.
But, you know, my daughter has that streak to her, that kind of, like, because she's so smart and because she knows it, like, that kind of maverick mentality on things. And this was a film I could show her and be like, okay, if you want to go that route, you just better bring it. You know what I mean? Because the reason, you know, Captain Marvel is awesome is because she's a top fire pilot and she's top all that. And, like, it reminds me of some of the stories I read to my daughter about, like, Mae Jemison, who was an African-American female astronaut, and the struggles she had to go through. But, you know, never saying die, basically, how hard they worked to get there. Yeah. So that's why I liked, you know, that
it's
message of
cool.
Captain Marvel. Yeah. Because my daughter needs that. It's a void, because two films in the past decade I can think of that I could be like, watch this. We were just watching Pirates of the Caribbean, which is like 20 years previously, and it was like the treatment of Elizabeth, Keira Knightley's character. I was like, oh man, this is how we used to write everything. Like, it had to be like damsel in distress shit. And it was such a big deal in the second Pirates film where she becomes the quote unquote pirate. And then, you know, Catherine turns to me and like, daddy, were there female pirates? Like, you know, we know from history, like, yeah, there's some damn good ones. Yeah. Like, I don't know why they're not
some
in this
the best.
Film. You know what I mean?
In the South China Sea, like the biggest pirate fleet ever.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, that's where the story part and the fanfare with Captain Marvel fit in with what I was looking for, because
I think it's important, like its place in history is better served by being removed from, do you know what I mean?
I think
stuff.
So, and I think Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck did a good job of preserving that, so you can watch it at any time, rather than the year that was women's empowerment, more so than the decade that isn't women's empowerment. We could still watch this and remember, this is, you know, this is a female archetype here. This is a someone to aspire to be. And I don't know, maybe it's, you know, I always tell you, maybe it's because I've been around strong women my entire life, but you know what I mean? Like, it's showing a woman as a leader.
It's cool. For sure. And I actually really liked right at the end when Sam Jackson is like starting his, you know, initiative, and he takes her like call sign, Avenger, right? The Avengers.
Well, that's right. I mean, he's a perfect example of that. He was the first time he was more of a sidekick. You know what I mean? And I just thought that was great, you know, because that's the way it should have played out. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't try to make his character more powerful or more whatever, because she was supposed to be the star of the show. And I just, again, in the writing, it was really well done, and it normally isn't. That's, I guess, why I'm pointing it out, because I can go back to other examples where it's like female lead, but then the male secondary character ends up taking...
And in fact, see, it's interesting. I want to watch Wonder Woman now again, because, I wonder if I would have different feelings.
Well, watch things like, you know, you see in the Disney films, and like Tangled, Tangled's all about, you know, Rapunzel, however there had to be Flynn, which is like, and and then the movie, you know, Tangled, she's the one that's doing everything, and she does it, and she's blah, 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 but then they have this like male lead character that's riding a horse all the time, and it's like, well, what does she need him for? You know what I mean? Like,
Right.
So I just,
It's interesting, isn't it, to see like kind of the pop culture like develop with the times. Because you do sometimes watch like old movies, you know, from back in the day, and you're like, wow, shit, like this seems so unreal.
Oh, I told you, we watched Love Actually over Christmas, and I was like, man, we were obsessed with like making fun of fat people in the 90s. Like, like everybody had to be stick thin back then. Thin, you know? Like, so, I mean, that's why, you know, at the end view, first of all, another great Marvel movie to watch and to see how two indie filmmakers really have done good. You know, that's that's from the podcast perspective. You say, well, why should I watch this, Jason? This isn't this just your MCU kick? It is, but it's tied into my love of being an indie filmmaker. And this movie was made by two great indie filmmakers.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I think that it's also what makes it super interesting is to see, you know, indie filmmakers transition into doing this kind of thing.
That's right. So
and being being more aware of it. Because, like, James Gunn, like, I just wasn't really aware of him in the indie scene, you know? Because it was before I really kind of, you know, got into filmmaking and stuff. And obviously it's amazing to see, like, how far he's come, right? But with Anne and Ryan, like, it's... like, I remember watching his debut film, you know? Like, I remember stuff like that, and it's just really cool. Again, like you said, you hit the nail on the head. Aspirational. Like, it's
that's something right. to aspire and to. Best part about that last bit, before we close out for the day here, like, last bit about that is, hear the difference that Ed is talking about in timelines. Because I go through this all the time. Remember, I am 38 years old with a really difficult, at the moment, full-time job. It happens. It gets busy sometimes, and right now I'm going through a very busy period. But, you know, I get to these points looking in the mirror being like, are you out of your mind? Like, what are you doing? You know what I mean? Like, you're saying you're an indie filmmaker. You're on every week talking about it. You're making films. But when is this going to pan out? Like, is it 45? Is it 50? Is it 60 that you're okay with things, you know, like, finally coming about? Like, I have to keep telling myself that there's not that sort of time frame with any of this. You cannot predict that. Yeah. You can put the moves in place and you can do the work, but it may take 10 years, it may take 2 years. You don't know. Like, the whole point is
it might never happen.
The whole point is you need to be ready for when to make your moves, when it is. So be trained, you know, keep practicing your craft. Make it so that if you did get that call from Disney, you know exactly what to say to them. That's the best.
Can you imagine? That's what I would love to have heard in the commentary, was them literally saying, yeah, like, the moment we got the call from Disney that we might be directing this, like, just and how that would go about.
You know? Go to the round table, again, because you have Disney Plus, you should have this. This is all the stuff that's on the special features with the... I have a box set for this. The Ryan Coogler round table, because he'll tell you about, like, how he was brought into that. And obviously, that's for all of you, you can go back to the gallery. They talk about that a little bit, about how... You know, I think David Filoni spends a lot of time talking about that. And he's kind of a different case because, obviously, he was like Star Wars.
From animation.
But the rest of them all talk about getting picked out and how that, like, went about and how they were talking. And it's just like Ed said, it's amazing, you know what I mean, to see how that happens.
Yeah, no, it is cool. I'll have to check that out, Black Panther.
Cool.
I'm so excited for all the extras and the commentaries that I now realize I have at my disposal.
I know, you'll be doing it.
Disney Plus, if you want to sponsor us. We'd be totally okay with that, but we love your streaming platform.
I just think, I mean, it's supposedly for the fans, but again, also, you know, and not just for that. If this helps young filmmakers, old filmmakers, whatever, like, get into the films more, then please keep including them. They're awesome. So
for sure.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion on Captain Marvel and taken away kind of some tidbits of information that is either useful or entertaining for you. Please remember always, and Eric, thank you very much for the share last week, but to share, you know, if you like the podcast, please.